Welcome to Clear Thinking, a GPS for the Christian mind, teaching you how to think, not just what to think. This is Joe Aguirre with theologian and philosopher Kenneth Samples. On today's podcast, we're pleased to have Dr. Stephen Berchi with us. Dr. Berchi is a chemist with a long career in the pharmaceutical industry. He's published more than 60 scientific articles and 30 book chapters on topics in his field. We'll get into more of Stephen's bio as we go, but first, welcome, Dr. Berchi.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
All right, Ken. Well, as usual, tell us why we have Stephen joining us today.
Well, Steve is a visiting scholar. He gave a great presentation last night to the scholar community. I'm going to ask him a little later to kind of summarize that talk. Tomorrow, he's giving a staff talk. And so we're putting him to work here and learning a lot from him. And Steve, in this kind of program, I'd like to hear more about who you are, how you came to know the Lord, what kind of motivations you had. I'd love for our listeners to appreciate your journey.
Yeah, sure. I honestly cannot remember not knowing the Lord. My wow. Mom and dad were Christians, and they led me to the Lord, they say, at three or four. I cannot remember the first time, you might say, of accepting the Lord as my Savior, and been following him. Can't say that I followed him perfectly for sure, but there was never a time when I had a faith crisis where I walked away for a short while from the faith. I've always had a deep belief in God and Jesus.
You know, Steve, it's interesting to me that in much of evangelicalism, we have the impression that people come to Christ at an altar call, maybe a crisis during their life. But I think the reality is that most Christians are born into a Christian family. They're introduced in that way. Of course, some people like a Hugh Ross and a Fuzz Rana have a very, a strong conversion. But I, like you, my parents taught me about the faith, and I didn't always walk it, but, it goes back a long time. Well, you're an intellectual. You have a lot of publications.
People that know me well and talk to me don't really regard me as an intellectual, but I appreciate that characterization.
Okay. What are some of the apologetic or theological writings or works that have kind of influenced you or shaped you? Where did that take you in terms of reading and thinking? And
well, I would say, early readings of C.S. Lewis in my life influenced me. And I think a notable one was Mere Christianity, where it really got me thinking about natural law, got me thinking about what is the case for Christianity from a defense of the faith sort of view. And that was very influential for me early on. And so I'm a C.S. Lewis fan.
Yeah, very good. How did you come to learn about Reasons to Believe? Lots of people I've spoken with over the last 25 years, they're engineers, they're dentists, doctors, and they often have kind of a, well, I'm a person of science, but I'm not sure how the faith connects to it. How did you kind of come upon Reasons to Believe?
Well, I'm going to start a little before that and say that growing up, I found myself, I have a high view of the authority of the Bible. Mm-hmm. And my understanding, and I would say in my early teen years to late teen years, was that if you really believe the Bible, you've got to take the creation as a six 24-hour period creation scenario. And so I had a lot of cognitive dissonance knowing that that had to be true, but having trouble with understanding the whole dinosaurs and cavemen and, well, not the cavemen so much, but how old the earth, the more I learned how old the earth and the universe appeared to be. So I was having cognitive dissonance. Not that it threatened my faith, but that I knew something wasn't making sense. Something's not right. It's the Bible's got to be true, and I couldn't pull these two things together until I ran across a book. It was Hugh Ross's book. I believe it was called Creation and Time.
Okay. Yep. That's
one of his early books. And I read that, and I said, this is making sense. Genesis really can make sense when you change your frame of reference, and it's so unbelievably true as you look through what to have been written so long ago and to be so consistent with what we now understand scientifically and naturalistically. It was affirming, like, okay, this is starting to make sense, that you can understand the Bible as teaching not necessarily a 6,000-year-old earth, but potentially older, that does not contradict with the Bible, with biblical authority and with my beliefs.
Yeah. Now, you're a chemist, you've worked in the pharmaceutical industry, researcher in the field. Is it your experience that maybe your colleagues that you've worked with or you've gone to school with, do you sense that there is a lot of feelings of science faith issues don't fit? Have you ever experienced kind of pushback or hostility about science and faith?
Yes, I have. And I would say there, I would say one thing first, that there are a lot of believers in the science world.
Okay.
And they tend to keep their heads down a little bit when certain topics come up, just because the reaction can be so sharp from the, I would say, an atheistic view, that they would start to put you into a flat earth sort of science denier or whatever kind of term they use, especially when the topic, they would try to bring in the age of the universe or the age of the earth, and that I could handle. And then when we got into a naturalistic evolution, there's an unwillingness to sort of talk about the mechanism of whether or not that mechanism is active. And it seems like there's, from some individuals, a lot of individuals who are atheistic in their views, that are scientists, are pretty strongly opposed to theistic views.
Yeah. I was talking with one of our visiting scholars, and I asked him, you know, he's a professor at a university. And I said, are most of your faculty that you work with, are they hostile? And he surprised me. He said, well, I think most of them are just kind of indifferent. They're living their lives. They've got families to raise, et cetera. So it's always interesting, because a lot of us who are not scientists, we do get this perception that there's this hostility between faith and science.
I would say that in general, it's a passive sort of, I don't really care. Just like you stated, it's not like overtly there all the time. But when the conversations do come up, there's usually a subset, I'll call it a minority. Some of the people who are atheistic are pretty strong and pretty loud, whereas probably the majority are somewhat not that concerned with it.
Okay. Joe, you want to jump in here and ask a question or two?
Yes. You have a long career in the pharmaceutical industry. You're a chemist, a member of the American Chemical Society. I believe that's what it is. Tell us what got you into that work and what you see as a chemist regarding questions about origin of life and so forth.
Well, I'm going to try to make this not long, but I have to start just a little before that. And in my whole life, all I really wanted to be, other than a Christian and a follower of Jesus, was a baseball player.
All right.
I played baseball through college 4 years, was on a national championship team at Lipscomb University in Nashville, Tennessee. Mm. And when I didn't get drafted, I thought I had a chance. And when I didn't get drafted and my only opportunity was a minimal one in rookie league, I decided that the Lord must not be in it. And I was going to give it over to him and try to figure out what else to do. And so the next 5 years transpired where I get a job in a lab, and I start finding out that working in a chemistry lab isn't that bad. I was used to working hard, and one, people would listen to you. They would ask you for advice. They'd treat you with respect. You had air conditioning and heating, and it was like you had enough time to do your work because they wanted the right answer. And so I found out that the actual work wasn't that bad. I had no idea. And then I wished I'd studied a little harder. So I took a few courses, and over the course of 5 years, prepared myself to go back to graduate school. And now I had a kind of, I think I like chemistry and I like science. And I went to Vanderbilt University, got a PhD.
It's a Catholic school.
No.
No, Vanderbilt is not.
No.
Okay.
No, it's just a public, private.
Okay.
It's not a Catholic school. And it's, I got a degree in organic chemistry, and I had a lot of purpose at that point. I really wanted to do well. I felt like I'd burned so much time playing baseball that I had to make up for it. And
what position did you play, by the way?
I'm a left-hander, and I pitched and played outfield. But in college, I only played outfield because if they were going to pitch me, they were going to not let me play every day. And
okay.
I wanted to play every day, and I like to hit. So I said, it's okay with me. I'll probably never make it as a pitcher. So I didn't make it as an outfielder, as it turns out.
Very good. Why chemistry? And I mean, you could have gone in different directions. What attracted you to it? Besides a nice office and respect.
I hate to say this, but not having to do projects in college for chemistry, but just having to learn the material was attractive to me. And I guess I must have had an aptitude for it because I learned it and I felt like I was accomplishing something, learning something real and learning truths and scientific facts. And it stuck with me. And I guess I had a knack for it. So I'd more discovered that I liked it because I discovered I was good at it in a
yeah.
way.
Now, Joe Aguirre and I have a difference. I think Ted Williams was the best hitter. He thinks Ty Cobb was the best hitter. Who would you side with there? Or do you have a third option?
Well, you know, you put Babe Ruth in there normally.
Well, okay. Right.
But I like the Ted Williams. He was a lefty, and he was all about the science of hitting. And I like that thinking. And so I was a big Ted Williams fan. But I think you got to sort of – Ty Cobb was unbelievable. But if you watch the swing, Ty Cobb was a strategic hitter, and he would put the ball wherever he wanted to, however he wanted to do it. And he didn't swing for the fences. But he could if he wanted to. But I'm a Ted Williams kind of fan.
You know, Joe, it's all about baseball, isn't it? Follow up with another question here, Joe.
Yeah, I want to hear a little bit more about your career. Tell us what you do, because you've written a lot of papers and book chapters in lay language, if you can. But I think we have a lot of science-oriented listeners who appreciate hearing, you know, about the details of the lives of other people in the sciences. And then for a little bit after that, what you see are some of the questions regarding origin of life. How do you see that as a chemist?
Yeah, so I would say what I came into the industry, and with my background in organic chemistry and analytical chemistry, I got placed in, fortunately, I sought out and got placed in a job that was responsible for studying how drugs degrade. You know, so you've got a drug, it's a molecular structure. When it degrades over time during your shelf life, what kind of impurities might it form? And so how do you determine what kind of degradation products might form in a short period of time? You have to expose it to some forcing conditions, and you have to do that scientifically so that you're not making compounds that would not naturally form, but ones that would form. And so what compounds might form? Are they toxic? Are they mutagenic? What are the structures? What are the pathways? How can you stabilize the drug so that it has a longer shelf life? And then also, how fast does it degrade? What are the kinetics? And how can you predict long-term shelf life in a short period of time? We don't want to wait 3 years to see how long the shelf life is. We want to figure that out in a few weeks so that we can develop formulations and ways to stabilize it to increase the shelf life.
Now, yesterday in your discussion, and I thought it was fascinating, you were relating just as a medication could degrade. You then brought us back to the origin of life and said that there's a lot of vulnerability there. There's a lot of ways in which life could have not come and because there are processes that are similar to degradation. Tell us a little bit about that. And where did you get that insight? How did that come to you?
Yeah, as I was thinking about, because I developed a lot of scientific experience with studying how compounds degrade, drugs are actually very similar in their characteristics and stability to the molecular building blocks of life. Mm-hmm. So when you think about carbohydrates and lipids and nucleotides and nucleosides and you realize and peptides for proteins, you realize that the kind of stability that I was studying is directly, it provides you insight into what kind of stability those molecular building blocks for the origin of life, with the idea being that if the Earth or the universe produces from inorganic materials, it produces organic materials in some way, which I think it does. And then those organic materials have to then assemble themselves somehow into molecular building blocks, which then polymerize in the right manner and then combine with each other in the right manner to form some sort of protocell that allows replication to occur and then magically kind of somehow evolves into having DNA code and life. It seemed to me that there was one problem that often was ignored or that I didn't see addressed, and that is as the Earth or the universe is making these compounds, it usually makes them in a gamish, which is a whole lot of compounds. And so if you sort through 1,000 compounds and you find, hey, I found a molecular building block here, here, and here, it's very dilute in a very unusable gamish or a situation. And when you think about having to accumulate those building blocks chemically, it requires stability of those things. Mm-hmm. So you'd have to make them and then you'd have to store them somehow so that they can be used later for some for the next reaction. Or you have to have a process that self-generates itself and propels itself into to building up into molecular building blocks and polymerized products. And we just, all of the research doesn't see, hasn't discovered those processes yet and kind of ignores the problem with time, and the time being the typical solution is, well, given enough time, those building blocks will build up and then provide the source of chemicals. But time is not just a friend in that sense. It's also an enemy because at the same time, those drugs are, those compounds are being built up. They're degrading. So it's complicating the significantly the simplistic story that I had heard.
You know, this is fascinating because when I talk with our scientists, I don't always understand all the weeds, but I try to track the reasoning process. And what I found fascinating in hearing you talk about that is you are kind of reasoning abductively, an inference to the best explanation. You're actually engaging in kind of an analogical reasoning. You know, here's what we know about the stability and degradation of medication. That's very similar to what would have possibly been there in the origin of life. So now, how did that come to you? Was it just flash of insight, or you just said, look, these seem to be comparable?
It was more along the lines of when I put my focus on it and I started thinking about it.
Okay.
As I'm getting more interested and I've developed, I've become an RTB scholar and I've become more interested in getting exposed to the topics out there in that field, science and faith and in the alignment. Origin of life was something that I felt like I had some knowledge that I could speak into. And I decided to kind of look at it a little bit. And I'm not the first to look to think about these sort of degradation processes and half-lives and the problems with building up. Chemists are in the origin of life field are looking at it, but I felt like I had some fairly good insight from my drug stability studies that called attention to the severity of the problem.
Let's talk a little further about these kind of big issues. I mean, it seems to me there's a number of issues that a naturalistic, atheistic perspective has trouble kind of accounting for. I mean, one of them is the origin of life. Another would be the origin of consciousness. We could go back to, you know, humanity and things of this nature. Why do you think that maybe lots of people don't see what we see? I mean, what do you think are the factors? I mean, when you lay out this information, I think it cries out for a rational mind behind the universe, call him a universal chemist, if you will, or, you know, an engineer. Or what is it that secular people don't see about? I mean, when I think of DNA, I think, duh, you've got DNA, you've You've got to have a coder. You've got to have somebody on the other end of this. With these big issues, why do so many people kind of stay with just a naturalistic, secular perspective in your mind?
I think I'm gonna back it up to say what is my view. My view is that I have no horse in the race, so to speak. That is, if there is a naturalistic process that could lead to the origin of life, even though we kind of, one of the laws is spontaneous generation doesn't happen. It must have happened once. If that could be found, that would be only point to a more amazing fine tuning to me than even fathomable. So I feel like I could embrace either way, but people on the other side can't embrace the idea that an intelligent being or a God could do it, because that's not methodological naturalism, it for one, and for two, it threatens their place in the universe, I think.
Yeah, kind of worldview issues.
So it's like forbidden to think about that, because then you, and I think there's a view that if you think that way, you're just invoking magic and you're not going to discover the things that you need to discover. You won't explore chemistry that you need to explore. I see it differently. I see that if you acknowledge a design, what we do is probe to find out what that designer did.
Yeah.
And it only motivates scientific accomplishment and achievement.
So some people would view it as a science stopper. You would say, no, it would make us pursue even further what the design, what the characteristics are.
Yes, exactly. I mean, because we believe there is design to it, we're going to discover things about that design and actually get insights into how God did various things. We don't just say, oh, God designed it, so therefore we're not interested, it's just magic. You know, God works supernaturally, but he also uses natural things to create through his design. And that's what has motivated scientists for centuries, since the 15th century or whatever, when, you know, the fact that God is a designer and he has order in this universe and it's studyable, I think is a direct result of a belief in God.
You know, listening to you yesterday, I have to say I never thought too much about the idea that if I have medication and I put it on the shelf, I always thought it's always going to be there. It's always going to be very effective. But you made the point that these medications, they may no longer be effective. They might even be hurtful to you if you were to take kind of used medications, if you will.
Yeah, and I'm not sure what the question is yet. But
I've never really thought about it. I never thought about a shelf life, that these medications are effective only for a period of time.
Yeah, well, and it's not a... you know, like they're perfectly effective and then there's a shelf life and they're not effective.
Okay.
It's a risk benefit calculation. And we're pretty conservative on that risk benefit calculation. That is, after the shelf life, there are certain degradation products and impurities that start forming. And many times those are not studied well enough to know if they're safe.
Okay.
So we want to err on the safe side if we know that it's safe and effective. Efficacy then would be a function of how much of the drug has degraded. So usually the shelf life is limited by the formation of impurities or degradation products, not the loss of efficacy.
Okay.
Other things that change are physical, so that they might not be absorbed as well, or they might not, it might look different and funny, and it creates a problem for people looking at it. But generally, it's not like something reaches a shelf life and it's automatically inefficacious and they're toxic. It's a conservative approach, very conservative.
What do you, I remember when I was in college reading that if you were a white male born in 1900, you might have a life expectancy of 47 years. I think today, if you were born and you were a Seventh-day Adventist and you're a woman, you might double the 47 years. How much of that has to do with the benefits of medication and things of that nature?
You know, that's a very good question. And it's one that if you'd asked me that about 15 years ago, I think I had seen some research on this, but I believe the number is roughly they attribute 10 years of that
Wow.
to improved medications.
Okay. Joe, question?
Yeah, a related question. Some people are leery of talk of medications and drugs and pharmaceuticals. They wonder if there's more risk than reward. They hear of outlier cases where things have happened and there were some poor outcomes. I would like to hear your perspective as a chemist who sees the details. And I guess the question would be, did God put these basic components of these medications somewhere in the creation and left it to the scientists and people doing research to find them to help humanity? I guess that would be the question.
That's an interesting way of framing it, and it builds on what is a specific field of pharmaceutical chemistry, and that is to look in natural products for active compounds. And so they look for biologically active. They can make screens, and they can screen natural products and then figure out which one of the what component, what molecule, what component or components are contributing to some particular effect, and then isolate, develop, oftentimes modify it to improve the safety benefit of that compound, and then use that in the drug that's and then test that in humans to see if it really works. But whenever you're messing, well, I shouldn't say messing. Whenever you're engaging with or interfering with introducing something to modify a system, a biological system, there's a risk associated with if you shut down this pathway, another pathway may crank up. I mean, it's a complicated system. So I think it is both a good reflection of what humans are capable of doing, and it we've demonstrated that it works. And there are also some problems that you can't discount completely, that there are some populations will have certain side effects and other populations won't. And that's part of the process of trying to determine the safety in over the course of toxicity studies and guided clinical studies. But your bigger question is, did God put these compounds in for us to discover, or are we doing something that God never intended for us to do? I think God sort of tells us, you know, wants us to tame the earth, to use it for the benefit of human flourishing, to use our brains that he gave us. And I think he provided with us in nature pretty much what we need to go find. I don't think you can avoid all disease and problems by having the perfect diet or using this perfect set of drugs. I think we're just frustrated by the nature of the world we that God created at the fall, that God created, and the nature of the fall, that we are human beings that are mortal, and we can't avoid that. I do think we have a desire by many who are atheistic to try to figure out how to overcome death. And I probably rambled on a bit long with that, but did I
answer
your question?
Yeah, that's great. Another question. You talked about the origin of life a little bit. It's been a while, Ken. I don't know if you've heard Fuzz Rana, but it's been a while since I've heard Fuzz either talk or write about the origin of life. That is where we are from a naturalistic perspective. And I'd like to get your comment on the Miller-Urey experiments and where we are in terms of finding a naturalistic origin of life. I think that it would help me. I hope it would help the lay listeners as well.
Yeah.
So the Miller-Urey experiment in, I believe, 1953 is sort of when it was published, maybe conducted in 52, was this little contraption that they made to spark energy into a gamish of inorganic materials that might have been present on the primordial Earth, as best they thought back then, to see if that kind of lightning-induced energy could cause the formation of certain organic compounds. And in doing that, conducting that experiment, a lot has been written about this. They made some bad assumptions, not knowing what the prebiotic atmosphere really was. And but even giving all the best case of you pick the atmosphere, you pick the conditions of putting in energy, what can you form? You form some amino acids in trace levels. You form a few other biologically related organics. So you can make organic molecules in low yields from this gamish of chemicals in this system. But it doesn't really go very far, anywhere near what we need to really think about how to make large quantities of relatively pure building blocks. So I would consider it to be a demonstration of the futility and not an example of, but it was a demonstration of the ability to create organic compounds out of inorganic materials in complicated, complex mixtures.
So would you say the progress has been stymied? There's been no further insight from a naturalistic perspective into how we could get the right chemicals at the origin of life.
Yeah, I think there's been much more sophisticated work done since then. And there's a lot, an active field in origin of life to try to figure out how the Earth could make the molecular building blocks and how what kind of reactions could build them up. Pardon me. I think the progress has been remarkable to Miller compared to where Miller and Urey were. But just looking at what the actual origin of life researchers say about where they're at relative to the true origin of life is that they assess that they're at the end of the beginning and they're logarithmically orders of magnitude off, far away from actually getting anywhere near something that would resemble a self-replicating life system. So there's, as I see it from their own literature, there's ideas on how they might get there, but it's all these, there might get there this way, that way or another way, but they're so far off that it's hard to see it as real progress from my view. And I feel like I don't have a horse in the race because if they did, I'd say, wow, look at, they're discovering what God actually did. And I just don't think they've discovered that or the hand of God did something miraculously that we'll never understand.
Yeah, that's helpful. Thank you.
Steve, let me ask you a two-part question. The first part of the question is, what do you think is the most probative, the most gripping argument in favor of God's existence or the truth of Christianity? And the flip side is, what do you think the biggest challenge is intellectually to believing in God and believing in Christ?
Oh, I'm going to go to the end of that first. The biggest challenge intellectually, I think, for most people is to abandon control, their own self-determination.
Wow.
And to actually trust in something outside of themselves. I think that is just not natural for people, and they don't... I think in this state, fallen state that we live in, we don't trust outside ourselves, especially to some God that we can't see, feel, or touch. And can you re-ask that question again? I know where I was going. You said something about what's the most gripping in terms of belief in God or Christianity. So can we stick with theism for a second?
Sure. What piece of evidence do you think really people have to take seriously in terms of pointing to God or pointing to Christ?
The complexities involved and the information involved in DNA storing information and then translating that into proteins and assembly. So you've got all the coding somehow, maybe not just in the DNA, but at least in the DNA, is required to create, self-replicate, to give birth to all the various things that happen in birth and life propagation. It's the information required is so enormous that it's incomprehensible to think how that could come out about without a designer.
Yeah.
Well, to me, that's the most compelling for a theistic, for the reality that there is a God. I think Jesus is the most compelling reason for believing in Christianity. But
yeah, very, very good. Well, as we start to wrap up our interview, Steve, tell us a little bit about your family. Tell us, what kind of influence have they had on you?
Well, I would say one of the questions you had asked me earlier was, is there a mentor that helped me early in my life? And I would have to say that was my dad most of all.
Wonderful.
And the reason My dad was a pastor, but what he instilled in me and I have an older brother and an older sister, is we could ask the hard questions, you know, from his sermon or from a biblical reading or whatever. And he never got thrown by it. He seemed to have this confidence that as long as we're exploring, asking questions and seeking answers in the Bible, that it would hold. And so that gave me the confidence that I don't have to be afraid to ask questions and to look deeply. And that provided a lot of confidence in moving forward with exploration and thinking.
Very good. Joe, any more questions on your
Well,
end?
more about your family and where you live.
Yeah, I live in a suburb of Indianapolis, Indiana. Go Colts. We live in Carmel, Indiana. I have a wife and four boys and two grandchildren. One granddaughter that was born a week ago,
Oh,
just a
wow.
week old.
Congratulations.
And then I have a son who is a grandson who is 8 years old now. So we have two and
And since you mentioned you played baseball and you like baseball, what major league team do you root for?
you know, growing up, I was a diehard Pittsburgh Pirate fan, and Willie Stargell was my favorite player. But when he retired, I lost interest. And since I was a baseball player, it was kind of hard to watch baseball for a while. And I ended up I'm kind of a fair weather fan for the Cubs now. But I'm not a hardcore fan. I follow more individual players than I do. And if the Cubs start doing well, I'll root for them again.
Do
I
you
remember the
remember?
Pirates, they called them the Lumber Company.
Yeah, exactly.
Do you remember Willie Stargell, how he would move
Oh
that bat
yeah,
around when he
exactly.
would get
I was at
ready
Dodger Stadium when Stargell hit it out into the parking lot, completely out of the stadium. What a shot.
to? Since he was my childhood, favorite baseball player, and second to that was Roberto Clemente. You know, but I always thought Stargell was underrated because of Roberto Clemente. But his power and his he's such a gentleman too. I always admired him.
All right, good to hear. Thank you. Okay, that's going to wrap it up for the podcast. Thanks for listening. We've been visiting with Dr. Stephen Bairchi. He's a chemist and he's been our guest on this podcast. Hopefully, you've gotten to know him and have heard some insights that will help you as you continue on in your sphere of influence. Let us know your comments and questions. You can reach out to Ken on X, and that's at RTB_KSamples. And we'll be glad to read your comment or question here. Get clear thinking sent to your device by subscribing to the Reasons to Believe podcast on Apple Podcasts, Podbean, and most podcast services. For Ken Samples, this is Joe Aguirre with a reminder that the goal of apologetics is not victory, but truth. Thanks for listening and join us for the next edition of Clear Thinking.
Thank you for listening. Your prayers and financial support are reaching people with reasons for faith in Jesus Christ, our Creator and Savior. To allow Reasons to Believe programs like this to continue, make your gift today at reasons.org.